Good morning. With an assassination in Turkey and a holiday maker's rundown at an outdoor Berlin Christmas market, international news is the focus of analyst Neil Conan. He joins us later this hour. And there's another lens to look at leadership, and it may not square with the incoming administration. Today's social critic Ashley Merriman considers the science connection between power and humility. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Author Chula Harrison gives us a preview of her new book, Rain, Hawaiian Wonder Boy. And champion surfer Tom Curran brings his musical side to a live performance in our studio this morning.
That's the conversation for this Tuesday, December 20th. Stay here. It all starts right after this look at today's headlines.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
You know, leadership and humility aren't always thought of as going hand in hand. Am I right?
Although Donald Trump didn't say earlier this year that he was a lot more humble than people thought he was. But we're going to talk about what that connection is between powerful leadership and humility this morning. Now, we're going to pick up a conversation begun almost 4 years ago with social critic Ashley Merriman. She's the award-winning writer and co-author of two books that call into question American narcissism and its reflection in the everyone wins philosophy that has informed decades of childhoods. Now she's turned her attention to the science of powerful leadership based in humility. Ashley Merriman joins us now by phone from Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, people have very different ideas of what it means to be humble. For the purposes of the studies that you considered, how is humility defined?
That is the first and most important question, I think, of all, because people think of humility as low self-esteem or abasement, and the scientists have actually found that the better definition, the more productive definition of humility is it is an accurate perception of your strengths and weaknesses in the context of the whole. And when we talk about the whole, we could be talking about a basketball player on a team, but we could also be talking about I'm standing at the Grand Canyon or at Waikiki looking at the vastness of the ocean and thinking, you know, all things considered, I'm really not all that much. But that realization isn't weakening, it's actually empowering.
A sense of reality in your own personal assessment is what I hear you say.
Exactly.
So how did this show up in, for example, the Duke University study that you looked at that regarded personality and individual differences?
Mm-hmm. Well, in that study, they had 155 people come into the lab, and they began by saying, you know, how often are you wrong? How often do you change your mind? And there were those they termed the intellectually humble who said, yeah, given new information, I do change my mind. I can be wrong. And the intellectually arrogant said, no, I'm never wrong. I never change my mind no matter what I hear. And then they gave them all pieces of information to read. And they timed everyone. How long do you take to read this information, absorb it? And the intellectually humble took longer to read the information, especially if it was material they didn't agree with. And the intellectually arrogant sort of just skimmed through everything. And then they gave them a quiz. You know, how familiar are you with Susan B. Anthony and Hamrick's Rebellion? And the trick there was there is no such thing as Hamrick's Rebellion. They made a third of the items up to see if people would say, oh, yes, of course I've studied that. I'm an expert. And what they found was that the intellectually humble took in more information, they recalled what they had read better, and they were better at knowing what they didn't know. And the intellectually arrogant skimmed through the information, insisted they were right, insisted they already knew everything, and new information was really just a waste of their time.
Ashley Merriman, I mean, the way you're describing this, I'm sure a lot of people are hearing shades of Donald Trump's approach to information.
I have thought that myself. It's fascinating, though, because all of this research was done, you know, a year or two ago, and then it takes a year to publish. So it's been sort of interesting watching the science being published in the last few months and the information regarding the president-elect. I think it's really important because we do want people to think more thoughtfully. And one of the things in the Duke study, which I was sort of aghast by, was this idea that if you disagree with me and I'm intellectually humble and you give me new facts, I reconsider them, just like the study. But the research indicates that the arrogant, when they're given new facts, don't respond like they're facts. Instead, they think it's a personal attack. You must think I'm stupid. How could you dare say such a thing? And if that, and blaming and this sort of hostile response, these are social contagions. We learn from watching people. And I really am concerned that if the discourse from the highest levels on down is, don't give me new facts, I'm already smart, it could be really destructive, even in an office and on a playground with kids.
So bringing this down to, you know, levels that are not necessarily government-related, mm-hmm. but for people who are running businesses, people who are in charge of teams, a sense of humility in being able to approach new information, being able to change a mind or to admit that you're wrong, could also be a team-building effect, not necessarily a loss of leadership.
Absolutely. And the researchers actually wondered if maybe sort of having a sword over your head all day was more motivating. And the research found that over time it's not. That, you know, there's an initial appeal to someone saying, I have the answers, only I know what to do. But after a certain point, that becomes disengaging for the people who work for him. They want someone to say, you know, I really need your help on this. I'm counting on you. And when you hear that, wow, you're counting on me? That becomes pretty exciting and motivating. And we want to work hard for that person. We want to make sure that what we're doing is accurate. And the humble leader also says, I put a priority on improving. I want you to improve too. I'm going to own mistakes. I want you to own mistakes. I want us to all progress and grow together. And when the humble leader says all of that, the followers do indeed go the extra mile, work on improvement. The arrogant leader who says, I'm great, doesn't give credit to others, says he already knows things, actually starts having his followers disengage, and they won't admit they were wrong because they don't want to be embarrassed. And they start modeling that aggressive, arrogant behavior. And the scientists have actually looked in the lab and in the field and found that humble leadership predicts 26% of the variance of one team's performance to the next. Humble leaders' companies make more money.
As you look at some of the reflections of these studies in reality, how prevalent is the humble leader compared to the more arrogant variety?
That is a great question. I don't think we have any exact numbers on it, unfortunately. I think that there's more humble leaders out there than we expect, but the main thing that the scientists have been focusing on, and really since the 1980s, is this sort of cult of the charismatic leader. You know, that there's a Lee Iacocca and a Steve Jobs, and they're really the one-man band. Everybody else is superfluous. And the researchers caution and say that that really could be destructive because most companies are really built on a collection of people. And the more we sort of celebrate that cult of personality of one leader, the more we have problems down the road because that narcissistic leader is more likely to cause problems. The non-humble narcissistic leader is more likely to have personal scandals, to not necessarily less ethical, but simply the arrogant leader takes more money and widens the pay disparity with his staff. The humble leader reduces pay disparity, increases the diversity, and diffuses the power in his organization.
Ashley, we've got to go in just a second here, but will there be some follow-up studies on this to really be able to look at some of those questions of prevalence and sort of where the trends are moving? Because we've had that cult of personality for such a long time that it's almost an expectation now, as you mentioned.
researchers are, this is a new field, so it's really kicked off in the past, like, decade. So researchers are absolutely right now looking at the prevalence of humble leadership in Shanghai, in the United States, and other countries to see how widespread it is. The first thing I wanted to know is it important? And research in the lab in the field has said, yes, it is. So now the next step is going to be then, how widespread is it? And I think even more excitingly, the question is, can it be taught? And
right.
Their preliminary research says, yes, modeling humility, asking people, is this an accurate assessment of your strengths and weaknesses, gets people to think differently about what they're doing.
Ashley, thanks very much for at least a small slice of these studies, and we'll check back with you as more develop. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you again. Ashley Merriman is the co-author of two New York Times best-selling books, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, and Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Her books have been published in 21 languages around the world, and she's won 9 national awards for her science reporting in publications including Time, Newsweek, New York, and The New York Times. Her recent piece for The Washington Post considers the new science of humility. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a surfing legend highlights his musical sign live in our studio. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Today marks the end of an era for The Conversation. Later in the hour, regular contributor and public radio legend Neil Conan will join us for his last segment of From the Farm. So to honor this milestone, the topic of today's backyard quiz is the man himself. You most likely know him from the long-running daily NPR show Talk of the Nation, which he hosted from 2001 to 2013. Over the course of his more than 40-year career in public radio, Neil has served in many roles for NPR, including executive producer of All Things Considered, foreign editor, news editor, and bureau chief. From where did that famous voice originate? Well, that's what we want to know today, and we want to know if you can tell us where in the world Neil Conan was born. If you can, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize. Should the deprivation of the senses always be seen as a handicap? Sometimes the absence of sight or hearing can lead to the extraordinary development of other senses. That's the case with the hero of Chula Harrison's new novel, Rain, the Hawaiian Wonder Boy. His story, written for young adults, has an inspiring message, and we've got the author on the phone. Good morning, Chula.
Good morning.
Tell me about Rain.
Well, I actually love this protagonist. It's my first novel, and he's not just amazing with his skill, because he develops, from not speaking, he develops ESP. He becomes psychic as he ages, and he just is tuned in and is always in the right place at the right moment to help someone who's in danger or death is imminent. So that is why he becomes the Wonder Boy. He's so humble, and he's got a sense of humor. He's grounded very much in a loving way. He sees life because he's in an alternative school where they teach to choose love over fear. He sees a lot of love in life, and realizes a lot of things early on that his classmates, who are characters themselves, are love learning with Rain. So for a long time he doesn't speak, and he, as I say, has these adventures all over Hawaii. And so it's a fun thing, because he's an ordinary human, humble, loving, funny, charming, but he's also not ordinary in that he's psychic.
Well, sometimes the things that we see as handicaps or the deprivation of a sense or an ability that we take for granted can actually lead to a heightened awareness in other areas. Do you think that's true?
Yep, absolutely.
Is that kind of what's going on with him, you think?
Yes, but to a much deeper level.
Yeah, into the realm of extrasensory mm-hmm. perception. Have you seen a lot of evidence of that out in the world?
Actually, not a lot of it. I know of people who have it, and I feel like we all have the ability, if we get still enough, to tune in. I certainly am a little too impatient to do that, but I know others who can.
But something in the nature of what one might call extrasensory awareness is out there, is available to us?
Definitely. I've read numerous books about tuning into that, yep.
Is that what led to the creation of this particular character?
You know, I honestly can't say that's what it was. I used to teach a class on feelings that I started in the men's prison here and mm-hmm. then took it into 14 schools. So, and then having four of our own children and 14 foster children, I then began writing. And I feel like just understanding human nature and I love adventure, so this just sort of came out.
Understanding human nature is a pretty tricky thing at best, but when you see it developing in children, I think that can enhance your understanding. You certainly have had plenty of experience of that.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think sometimes I was MIA as a mother, as I guess we all are occasionally, especially with four children, but I loved and adored my children the whole time and still do, and then my grandchildren. So between that and the foster children, my husband and I feel very blessed. But yeah, you do start to notice human nature and how it develops and their personalities from little Keiki on.
You describe being MIA as a parent, but that's not always a bad thing, is it? I mean,
no, I feel like it was in our, with my husband and I, it wasn't a good thing, because our youngest was our daughter at that point, 3, and the first 5 years of a child's life is the most important for their developing. And at that point, we lived in Australia, which we have done this before. We've lived in different places. My husband was a full-time teacher at Iolani. He would just take a leave of absence. And we lived there for a year and had the time of our lives. We just adored those Aussies. They're wild and funny and quirky. And so we kind of went along with it too much.
Well, I mean, the kids turned out okay, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. They're fabulous. The oldest is a chiropractor. The second is a dean of a school. Like my husband, he got into education. The third was an acupuncturist as well as a pro surfer. Then he let go of the acupuncture, and he's still a pro surfer at 46, even though he's a parent. And then the youngest is a therapist. So, yeah.
Well, you know, we live in an age of the so-called helicopter parent who hovers over everything, and people are starting to wonder if that's the way to go. That sometimes,
no, I think that's definitely detrimental. It my husband saw this at Iolani School. If you do that, then when they're on their own, it's frightening. They don't make decisions. They can't have that, you know, conviction of their thoughts, and they don't choose perhaps with any confidence of what's going to happen in their lives. And that's what the whole thing about Rain is. He starts understanding how to choose early on things that are positive and work for him.
Does he have the ability to speak but just choose not to use it, or is it?
Well, that's part of the story. Eventually he does, eventually, but I won't go there because that's a fun Well, it's an exciting adventure in itself. There's a lot of adventure in the story, and yes, eventually when he's about 16 or 17, he does. And he doesn't have to write his words, which is how he communicates the first many years of his life. He has to write everything. So this frees him up to be able to help others eventually when he can speak. It definitely makes a difference in the sorts of ways he saves and rescues people.
Well, Chula, thanks very much for telling us about it. Sounds as if he waits until he has something to say, which might be a lesson for us all.
That's true, too. Yeah.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Chula Harrison is the author of Rain, the Hawaiian Wonder Boy, from Legacy Isle Publishing, an imprint of Watermark Publishing of Honolulu.
Governor Ige released his budget wish list with more money for schools, housing, and homelessness. But are the amounts he's requested in sync with tax expectations? Chad Blair joins us now from Civil Beat with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we've heard the top line figures with all of this.
Sure.
But it seems that there may be some disconnect between what lawmakers expect for tax revenues and what the Council on Revenues may show up, have show up in their projection, and what the governor wants. Is this more a positioning for the governor than actuality, or something that could actually happen in reality?
Well, and just remember, it's really just a draft. It's the first time we've seen the budget. Of course, it's going to go to the House and Senate money committees, and they're going to tinker with it big time, and then it'll go back up to the governor's desk. So, yeah, this is just a blueprint going forward. The governor knows this himself, right? He's a former Ways and Means chair. He has crafted budgets. But there was some concern on the part of Senator Jill Takuda. She chairs WAM, and Representative Sylvia Luke, who chairs the House Finance Committee, that, is there going to be enough money to pay for this? Because this is a biennium budget, meaning for the next 2 years, there's actually an increase of 4 and 5% respectively. So you're going to need more revenue anyway. Where is it going to come from? And both chairs said, our economy, while it's doing pretty good, is actually starting to slow down. In particular, the general excise tax revenues that we've been seeing the last couple of months, they're actually flat. So the question is, are we going to have enough money to pay for everything that the governor wants?
So that sort of brings up the question, why get everybody excited about these things, as great as this all is, without having enough, of a reality check of the monies that are expected so that you can deal with apples and apples?
Right. One of the things the governor wanted to do was to set forth a vision. And he actually said the budget is the primary driver of this state. And what's in that money, what's in the various appropriations, is going to determine how we go forward as a state. And that's why he's placing so much emphasis on education. He happened to say that, look, we used to have agriculture as our main industry. Then it's tourism. What's it going to be in the future? He'd like to have an innovative economy, an educated populace. And he says, you got to start doing that now. That's why so much money is in there. And by the way, we have had 5 record years of visitor arrivals. Things are looking pretty good. We got a strong bond rating. So he generally struck an upbeat tone, which I think maybe is his job. It is also the job of Luke and Takuda to say, wait a minute, let's be skeptical here. By the way, missing from all this is any money for pay raises for 14 units of the 4 public sector unions. And that's a big question mark that both Luke and Takuda are wondering about.
So really looking at this, how aspirational it may be, there are clearly some holes in there, but we're going to be talking about that as it's refined and as we go forward. Thanks very much, Chad. We're going to talk to you tomorrow morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check from Civil Beat. A
Aleppo finally falls to pro-government forces in Syria, and there's a quiet end to the drone drama in the South China Sea. Those are just a few of the stories on the mind of Neil Conan, who's our news analyst and who joins us each week. He joins us now from his MacNut farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, there's a direct link between those two stories today. After that lone gunman shot Russia's ambassador to Turkey, he shouted, "Remember Aleppo, remember Syria."
Yes, this was at an art exhibition in the Turkish capital. The shooter was an off-duty Turkish police officer working security at the event, and I'm sure you saw that chilling picture of him standing calmly in a suit behind the ambassador, Andrei Karlov, and then opening fire. We do not see the subsequent shootout where the assassin is killed by Turkish police.
Sometimes we get lucky. But the assassination of Russia's ambassador is in the capital of a NATO country and understandably is making people nervous.
Yeah, and this would have been much more serious as recently as a year ago when Turkey had, you'll remember, just shot down a Russian fighter plane during the along the Syrian border. But there has been a remarkable rapprochement between Ankara and Moscow since then. There are still important differences between them on Syria, but President Erdogan's crackdown since the attempted coup last summer has left him, you know, nearly as estranged from Europe and the United States as Vladimir Putin. So the two autocrats have found common cause in that. Now, there have been demonstrations in Turkey against Russian policy in Syria. That's a big issue there, but there is no chance that this assassination will be seen as an act of war, but rather as an act of terrorism.
And today, German Chancellor Angela Merkel labeled yesterday's awful incident in Berlin as terrorism when a man drove a speeding truck into an outdoor Christmas market.
Yeah, this may have more political fallout than the assassination will. First reports identified the driver of that truck as a young man from Pakistan, one of the hundreds of thousands who arrived in Germany as a refugee in the last year, and part of that wave that was welcomed by Chancellor Merkel. And now that man has been released by the police for lack of evidence, so they do not know who was behind the wheel, and his motivation, therefore, has to remain a matter of speculation. But immigration, of course, has become a major issue in Germany, as it has in so many other places. If this does turn out to be an act of terror by an immigrant, it will resonate with the criticism made by the Alternative for Germany, that's the extreme right-wing party that's been gaining popularity ahead of national elections there next year.
It's interesting, too, that President-elect Trump identified this incident as terrorism in a tweet yesterday, you know, well before the authorities in Germany felt they had enough information on what happened. Was that luck or was that just the same refrain?
Well, one thing we know, it was not based on any intelligence briefing the president-elect attended. We've had Donald Trump firing off tweets all during the campaign. On nothing more than gut response, this looks like exactly the same thing. And he may, as you point out, turn out to have been right on this attack in Berlin. But, you know, from time to time, what might seem obvious in the immediate aftermath of an incident turns out to be something else altogether. And, I think it's troubling that Mr. Trump continues to respond off the cuff without pausing to think this through or without the benefit of intelligence.
Last week, we talked about his open feud with the CIA over its assessment that Russian intelligence intervened in the election on his behalf. Now, though, the FBI has reportedly come to the same conclusion without changing minds of the Trump transition team.
No, this is still being painted as, you know, a partisan effort, to undermine the legitimacy of the Trump election by, you know, sore loser Democrats. A month away from inauguration, you know, there are so many questions about Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. You know, the president-elect canceled a news conference he was supposed to have last week where he was going to address those issues. He still has not released information on his business holdings or on his tax returns. Now, maybe his sensitivity on all this is going to be assuaged by yesterday's vote by the official electors that confirmed his victory last November. But so far, his camp says, you know, all of these issues are just distractions by sore losers. When it's, you know, it's absolutely clear that on the intelligence issues and on the conflict of interest issues, it's not just Democrats who are worried.
I want to jump back to Syria for a moment and those awful images of refugees streaming out of the ruins of Aleppo after rebel resistance there finally collapsed over the past couple of days and the evacuation arranged by Russia and Turkey. What do you make of this?
Well, it's obviously a major victory for President Assad, for Russia, which provided the air power and the weaponry, and for Iran, which provided much of the manpower for the siege. At the end, there were reports of summary executions and large-scale arrests and last-minute artillery attacks with little apparent purpose beyond revenge. There was an eloquent denunciation of Syria, Russia, and Iran by Samantha Powers, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, when she spoke about the blood on the hands of those who carried out the atrocities in Aleppo. But, you know, this has to be seen as a failure for the United States, too. You know, maybe the signal foreign policy failure of the Obama administration. Crimes of omission, perhaps. But some degree of responsibility for the tragedy in Aleppo lies in Washington as well.
So where will those refugees from Aleppo go now?
To Idlib, which is just to the west. It is still held by rebel forces. It is a stronghold of the Nusra Front, which is a group allied with al-Qaeda, which is going to provide some justification for the government when they claim they are attacking terrorists. Many fear Idlib will just be the next siege, the next massacre, and that these refugees have nowhere safe to go inside Syria and no place ready to accept them outside.
That seems to be a familiar refrain now, too. But moving on, let's go to the crisis that wasn't. A few days ago, China pulled a U.S. Navy drone out of the waters of the South China Sea. Washington objected. There were outraged tweets from President-elect Trump, and Beijing answered back. And then we hear today that China quietly returned that drone. What happened here?
Yeah, well, the facts of the matter do look pretty outrageous. An unarmed U.S. naval ship was operating two unmanned underwater vessels just off the coast of the Philippines. Now, this is clearly international waters, clearly outside the vast area of the South China Sea that's claimed by China. Obviously, those claims are disputed, but this is outside even those planes, outside the so-called nine-dash line. Now, these drones, you know, glide along the surface of the water and use sonar to map the bottom of the sea and other sensors to measure, you know, water temperature and salinity, all of which are very useful bits of data for submarines or for anti-submarine warfare. But again, this is international waters. They have every right to be there and every right to do this. Anyway, a Chinese vessel was shadowing the American ship, normal for this part of the world. And as the Americans recovered one of these drones, the Chinese sent out a small boat to pick up the other one. And from there, we depart the realm of facts and get into speculation about why.
Okay, well, I guess a first guess was that this was a response to Donald Trump's phone call with the president of Taiwan and a message to the president-elect.
Yeah, that's one theory. Another is that Chinese sailors just saw an opportunity to thumb their noses at the Americans, or that this is the latest calculated step in the slowly escalating tension between the U.S. and Chinese militaries, another in a long series of provocations by both sides. And the one thing that nobody believes is the official Chinese statement that their sailors stumbled across a floating piece of unidentified equipment that they removed as a hazard to navigation.
So was this drone like super secret technology?
Well, since they returned it, you could be pretty sure it wasn't. This drone has been described as mostly off-the-shelf, commercially available technology. And while you have to note that word, mostly, if there was anything remarkable about the drone itself or about its sensors, I'm sure the Chinese would have dragged this out long enough to take the thing apart and examine it. If you remember that incident, you know, way back at the start of the George W. Bush administration, so 2001, a U.S. Navy reconnaissance plane made an emergency landing on China's Hainan Island after it collided with a Chinese fighter jet. Now, the crew came home after a few days, and the Chinese eventually returned the PC-3 plane as well, but they returned it in pieces.
Well, Neil, we're going to have to leave it there, and very much to my regret, not just for this week. Neil is working on a new project, so this will be the last of our Tuesday morning visits.
Beth-Ann, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed our talks almost 2 years now. I'm not quite ready to talk about that new project, but I hope you'll have me back on when we get plans a little firmed up, and that should be soon.
You bet, Neil. We'll be looking forward to hearing about it. And what about the Pacific News Minute, though?
I'm going to try to continue those if I can. The schedule to write those is a little more flexible than the conversation we have Tuesday mornings, but I'm going to miss our time on these Tuesday mornings.
We all will. Thanks very much, Neil.
You bet, Beth-Ann. Thank you.
News analyst Neil Conan is signing off from the farm, but as noted, you can continue to hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Hi, good morning. I'm Louise King Lanzalotti from Kalikolehua. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. You may have heard somebody say, your great-grandpappy made it through eighth grade and then dropped out to work the farm. For a very long time, passing eighth grade was the goal for many. It was thought by then you had learned all you needed to know. These days, it's achieving success in ninth grade that's crucial. Doing poorly puts students at jeopardy. In Hawaii, there are 37,000 kids preparing for ninth grade. 6,000 of these students will not graduate from high school. The Hawaii Community Foundation, along with other donors, decided to help these kids succeed. They funded 10 middle schools to develop best practices for improving student success. Connecting for Success is the resulting program. The first step is to identify endangered students. Then counselors come to the rescue, and so far, they've reached about 1,500 kids. Connecting for Success is still in its early stages, but I'm pretty sure we all want them to succeed. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And in today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about the conversation's favorite radio personality turned macadamia nut farmer, Neil Conan. We just heard from Neil for the final installment of his weekly From the Farm segment. To honor that milestone, we asked you to give us his place of birth. The birthplace of his radio career was in New York City at WBAI, one of the first public radio stations in the country. After his first on-air experience, one of Neil's early supervisors predicted, "This kid is never going to make it." Luckily, that prophecy proved false, and Neil went on to a long and diverse career in public radio. You may have guessed that Neil's life and career share a birthplace, but you'd be wrong. Neil was actually born in Beirut, Lebanon, where his father was serving as the head of the medical school at the American University of Beirut. And at 8:45, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Fine Dining Restaurant 53 by the Sea, located in Kaka'ako, announcing a New Year's Eve gala speakeasy affair based on The Great Gatsby. Reservations at 53bythesea.com/NYE.
Think of how often you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for music, culture, and companionship. The station has been here for you every day, all year long. Before 2016 comes to a close, we urge you to make a tax-deductible gift to support the programming you enjoy. We gratefully acknowledge Linda Bremenes of Honolulu, Valerie Brown, and David Case of Kailua Kona for their generous support. Now, could it be your turn? Call 955-8821 during business hours or click donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. Tom Curran has a decades-long career as one of the world's top surfers, but he's also an accomplished musician whose skill on the waves has taught him more than a few lessons about making music. He's performing in Waikiki tomorrow evening, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Chris.
Did surfing, I'm hoping that surfing taught you some lessons about playing music, did it?
Yeah, well, that's, you stumped me there. I don't know quite how to answer that. Surfing,
well, it calls for concentration.
Yes, right. Well,
immersion surf, in what you're doing.
Yeah, surf music is something kind of like that, I think. Surfing has a certain rhythm to it, and same with music. I think you sort of have to be in rhythm, that sort of thing. Yeah, sure.
Well, you can't exactly let your mind wander, right?
You No, but see, you know, now that you ask that question, the good part about surfing sometimes is that you're out there sitting there and you're not really doing anything. So if you're thinking about music sometimes, or, you know, if you're not talking to somebody, that's okay too, because I think that slows down everything a little bit. You know, you're just out in the ocean and music pops into your mind, and then, you know, getting to play with other musicians and being able to develop sounds and do songwriting and things like that. Yeah, I think what you're saying, that surfing is sort of helps too, yeah.
Do you get musical ideas when you're out there, and then when you get on shore, pick up a guitar or a keyboard? And
it has happened, actually, yeah. It sounded a bit like a cliche, but, you know. And a lot of times it's maybe when the waves are not that interesting, you know.
Fill up the time, yeah. What kind of subject matter do you touch on in your songs?
I try to be as vague as I can, and general sort of themes, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, you want to make something that's okay for everybody, not just somebody's personal rant or, you know, somebody's private life, or I don't know what, you know, but I'm trying to make songs that I'm not going to get tired of in, you know, 2-3 months, 3-4, you know, years of, you know, developing these songs with the artists that I get to play with. You know, you have to have songs that you're not going to just not want to play because they're not very good. I mean, that's kind of the motivation. As far as subject matter, yes. You know, everything, yeah. Everything.
How long have you been doing music?
I started out playing drums when I was about 5, and then a little bit of guitar from about 14.
Uh-huh. How about keyboards?
This is last, not so long, actually.
That's the most recent
yes,
addition to your music?
Yes.
Well, you've brought a song in, and you've brought a guitarist with you.
Yes, this is Hironobu Saito from Japan. We met a few years ago in Miyazaki, where he's from. And, you know, he surfs, and he knows some of the... some friends in Hawaii as well. We were talking about Titus Kinimaka and some other mutual friends, and basically we just I just was always going, you know, come here, you know, we need to play music because he's really that good, you know, and so that's where we met.
Well, Hiro has brought a miniature guitar, I guess you'd say. Could you just play a couple chords? Let us hear the. Kind of halfway to ukulele sound a little bit, both the six strings and the range of a guitar. Well, what's your song, Tom?
We're going to try a new song called Human Creature.
And you're playing keyboard, and Hiro is playing his miniature guitar.
Yes.
So let's hear it.
Come too far. by, reaching for the sky, trying to make it to the top of the tree like the eagle fly. I don't know why, reaching for the sky.
You know, Tom, I thought of that song when I asked you about the subject matter, because it can really hear the, you know, what happened to the birds in the sky. As a surfer, you're obviously also interested in conservation. How could you not be, right?
Yeah, we're all reminded of that. And then, even in Hawaii, you can come down with a, you know, sinus infection or something from surfing dirty water, just like everywhere. But, you know, it's really, you know, heavy stuff going on in the world. And, you know, if you want to make a film reel of what happened in Japan, you know, it's very sad. And so, I don't know, we're here on the radio. We need to talk about something, talk about positive things. And then, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we just want to bring attention to as well.
Well, that's the kind of thing that you best express through your music, right? Thanks very much for coming in.
Appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
Tom Curran and Hironobu Saito will be performing tomorrow evening at Blue Note Hawaii, and Tom's most recent recording is called In Plain View.
Codebreaker is a program from Marketplace Tech that is all about how technology is making an impact on our lives, from the devices we interact with every day to the cutting-edge stuff we're just starting to learn about. We're going to look at where tech is now and where it might be going in the coming year. Along the way, we've got a story of Siri saving a mother's life, a woman in her late 70s trying virtual reality for the first time, and a special holiday code, and much more.
This morning at 10.
Beth Ann, I was really interested in that study of arrogance versus humility and the nature of arrogance. You know, the idea that you could be fed fake information and said, yeah, oh, I know all about that, right?
Oh, yes, that, what was it, like the Henkin Rebellion or something, utterly ridiculous.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it stems from this idea that somehow we feel like we always have to be right, or a lot of people do, and really not feeling comfortable to say, you know, I don't know that, but I'll get you an answer, or that's interesting, tell me some more. I mean, really having, I don't want to just say an open mind, but feeling comfortable within your own skin to know that you can't possibly know everything, and you can't possibly have everything that is correct.
Well, speaking as somebody who's been wrong thousands of times, I can tell you that it doesn't kill you. You know?
No, and you've heard Neil Conan say many times, you know, I was wrong in that,
yep.
But picking up and moving on, well, that's just how it is. And good for someone who can be humble, which is maybe not what we're going to see a lot of as we come
to
January 20th.
That'd be nice too, though, wouldn't it?
Well, we'll see what happens. Meanwhile, what's going to happen for us right now is we're going to say goodbye, but we'll be back tomorrow morning. And I'm going to have a sit down with director Linda Chu Takayama and talk about the labor and seasonally adjusted employment rates, unemployment rates for November, and where we go from here.
And rock and roll veteran Mike Pirana is going to bring us holiday music live in our studio.
We always like to hear from you, and you can call us and leave us your live comments on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Please just be sure to leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. And if you like email, we've got that too. It's talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We archive all our past shows, and you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkoot.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.